So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. This episode of the Media Twits is sponsored by the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, which is accepting applications for its entrepreneurial journalism programs. Get more details at bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. That's bit.ly/CUNYJSchool. And joining me from New York is Rifat Ali. How are you doing, Rifat?
Hey, Mark. Doing well. Looks like the fall is fully in place in New York, and we're moving towards the winter, so I guess we're all getting ready for that.
Definitely. And for us out here, there's a lot going on in the baseball world. The fall always brings the playoffs, and my three favorite teams are all in the playoffs today, so it's a big day for me. I know you don't really follow baseball as much, more cricket, but this is more of our fall tradition, I guess.
What sport is that again? I don't know.
It's the bastardized version of cricket.
Exactly.
Because I remember you had to actually skip our podcast for, what was it, like 2 or 3 weeks because of the World Series of cricket?
Yeah, or the actual World Cup, not like five teams in America calling it the World Cup. It was the actual World Cup.
Right, the World Cup. Sorry about that. The World Cup of cricket.
Yes, the World Cup of cricket. Cricket World Cup. Yeah, that was, I think, a year and a half ago, yeah. Which India won, by the way, so.
Yeah, I didn't mention that. I guess more people probably even watch that than watch baseball, I bet.
In terms of absolute numbers, probably, yeah. And a lot of it is done online, especially in the US and UK and other places outside India.
Yeah.
So
yeah, today, it's interesting. We're going to talk a lot about videos and just the way, you know, kind of the free speech versus hate speech that goes on. And, you know, in different parts of the world, what gets blocked, what isn't blocked, what gets pulled down. And you've traveled all over the world. Do you have experiences? Do you remember being in certain countries and trying to get onto Facebook or YouTube and seeing things that were pulled down or sites that were blocked?
Yeah, no, all the time. I mean, a lot of the countries, Saudi Arabia, famously, I remember going in 1999 and not being able to access, I think, Hotmail at that point. Gmail did not exist. Then I was in Tunisia 2 months before the revolution happened there. And you couldn't access certain sites, even in a very cosmopolitan city like Dubai. I think it's changed now, but 2 years ago, Skype was not accessible, which is what we use to record our show here. I think it's changed now. They had an alternative to Skype, like the local people there. And I think it connected to Skype so you could call people, something like that. So I've seen that a lot in a lot of countries that I go. In Uzbekistan, I remember some issue. Burma, until recently, you couldn't access Gmail, but now it's changed, so now it's fine. But even a lot of sites in Burma were censored. I think YouTube, if I remember right, was censored in Burma.
Yeah, and I guess it's a tricky situation for websites as far as having to kind of deal with what's going on locally and what the sensitivities and what all the laws are. It's kind of a tangle for them to figure out, you know, what you can post and what has to be pulled down in all those places.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things that happen that we don't have even here in US, like YouTube, India, they get served like all kinds of notices all the time. In Pakistan, the same thing. Orkut, which was a social network that was big in India before Facebook came along. It was owned by Google. They used to get tons of requests for all kinds of stuff to be removed. And they became a magnet for all kinds of crime as well. But anyway, so they have – their fate has gone completely now since Facebook has become big. But anyway, all these kind of things keep happening that we don't hear here.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, today we're really – it's going to be a special episode of our podcast – looking at this idea of the balance of hate speech and what's also called dangerous speech and free speech and freedom of expression when it comes to these online services like Facebook, YouTube, Twitter that have to deal with the laws of so many different countries. And we have a really interesting kind of round table of guests to talk about that. years, online services such as YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and others have dealt with balancing free speech and hate speech concerns in various countries where their content's viewed. Most recently, the controversy over the Innocence of Muslims video on YouTube led to the video being pulled down in some Middle Eastern countries temporarily while staying live in the U.S. and Western countries. That might have led to violent protests with deaths in Libya and Pakistan. So these tough judgment calls by online services can lead to difficult situations on the ground. We asked a lot of these companies to participate in the podcast, and they all declined. While Google and YouTube declined to participate, they did they reiterated their stance on posting videos in a statement to us. The statement read, "We want YouTube to be a community everyone can enjoy as well as an important platform for freedom of expression. This inevitably raises tensions over some videos because what is okay in one country may be controversial in another. As we have always made clear, this video, Innocence of Muslims, is within our community guidelines. We only restricted access to it in Libya and Egypt on a temporary basis due to the very difficult circumstances there. Now that the situation is calmer, we've reinstated the versions that had been restricted." And that's the end of their statement. Here are the guests who are going to be joining us for the roundtable discussion. Susan Benesch is senior fellow at the World Policy Institute in New York, where she directs the Dangerous Speech Project. Benesch also teaches international human rights at American University's School of International Service. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Trevor Timm is an activist and blogger for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, where he specializes in free speech and government transparency issues. He's also contributed to The Atlantic, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, Foreign Policy, and PBS Media Shift. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Jonathan Peters, who's a media lawyer and the Frank Martin Fellow at the Missouri School of Journalism. He blogs about free speech for the Harvard Law and Policy Review, and he has written on legal issues for The Atlantic, Slate, Wired, The Nation, and PBS Media Shift, among others. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thanks, Mark.
So, Susan, let's start with you. You've been doing some work on what you call the Dangerous Speech Project. Can you explain a little bit about that project and how you define dangerous speech versus hate speech?
Yes, the idea is that hate speech is a huge, vague, and variously understood category, and that only some hate speech is actually dangerous in the sense that it increases the chances of violence. So I've been working on describing the speech that does make violence more likely. That's extremely context dependent. So certain speakers are more able to influence certain audiences. Certain content is much more inflammatory, especially in particular social contexts. And then there are social and historical factors that can make people more likely to respond to certain speech.
So let's say there's a way that YouTube could detect dangerous speech, you know, as it happened or before some kind of violence broke out, would that be a reason for them to, let's say, take down material?
Well, as Google and YouTube have said, they've got a set of what they call community guidelines. And the Innocence of Muslims video didn't violate those guidelines. The guidelines don't include dangerousness. In other words, they're not seeking, in most cases, to block or take down content because somebody is likely to respond violently to it. So they would have to change their guidelines in order to include dangerousness.
But do you think they should?
I think that it would be difficult or impossible. First of all, by trying to write community guidelines for the entire world, they're already embarking on something extremely difficult because, of course, there are so many different communities all over the world. So what's dangerous in one place or in one normative community isn't dangerous in another one. And as we saw with the Innocence of Muslims, The thing is, by the time Google and YouTube see violence in response to a particular piece of content, it's really too late to prevent the violence or to block it. What those companies can do is explain their decisions to those of us online, and that can over time have a civilizing effect on online discourse.
This is Rafa. Question for, I guess, any of you, but Trevor specifically, what kind of guidelines do you think startups that grow very quickly? I mean, Google, with the company of that heft, has access to a lot of resources. But just take an example of a company like Instagram, which came about in a year. Now they're of course owned by a large company, Facebook. But if they had an incident like that, what access would they have to any kind of resources besides the legal that are part of the company and of course are restricted by the amount of resources that they have? I mean, would EFF be that body really they would come to?
I mean, we're always willing to help up and coming companies craft free speech friendly policies. And I think, you know, in the case of Google and YouTube generally, throughout their history, they've been fairly good. You know, it's been said that the top decision maker at Google is actually more important in the free speech world than any Supreme Court justice these days, because they have so much power over what people can and can't see. And, you know, generally on YouTube, they have different policies than they do their blogs. On YouTube, they usually don't allow, you know, obscene material or, you know, hate speech. But on their blogs, they have a much broader standard that formulates well to, you know, the First Amendment's idea of incitement, which is, you know, only speech that is directed to inciting and likely to incite imminent lawless action is not protected under the Constitution. And they've been fairly good at keeping to that standard, at least on their blogs. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier in the program, this video actually did not violate any of their terms of use. You know, it may have been offensive and disgusting and just plain weird, but there was no incitement in the actual video. This video was certainly meant to be provocative, but it wasn't calling for people to rise up in violence and kill people, and that's the standard that it's always been in the U.S. And it's important for companies now that they have this outsized influence on how people speak, that they live up to those, to the ideas, at least in the First Amendment.
Trevor, do you what do you think about this idea that Susan is looking into, which is kind of this dangerous speech? Do you believe that dangerous speech should be restricted more?
Well, I think the old saying goes, if you don't believe in free speech for people who you despise, then you don't believe in free speech at all. I think this, you know, the way the First Amendment works now is it's not an absolute ban, or it's not an absolute license to say whatever you want. There are restrictions. You can't directly threaten somebody's life, and you can't directly incite violence if it's likely to actually incite imminent lawless action. So there are limits. The idea that we should expand those limits into another category of speech, whether it's hate speech or something like the Innocence of Muslims video, could be very dangerous. I mean, for example, if you take the Innocence of Muslim video and look at what actually happened, we could be setting a very dangerous precedent if this was the type of video that could be potentially censored. You know, there's something called in free speech canon in the U.S., the heckler's veto, which occurs when the acting party's right to free speech is curtailed in order to prevent a reacting party's behavior. And this could lead to all sorts of situations where a group can, you know, use violence to essentially silence somebody's actions that normally would be protected under the free speech clause. So you know, it's obviously a very tricky situation when you're dealing with the internet, where you have all sorts of these different countries with all sorts of different cultural backgrounds. But the important thing to remember is these policies that kind of push for censorship can end up backfiring and lead to more censorship. And that's kind of what we want to avoid.
Jonathan, what about in the legal angle for all these companies? You know, the weird thing about the internet is that, you know, you have to, I guess, conform to laws in all the different places where your servers are based. Is that how it works? I mean, so basically, I've heard before that, you know, a law that's passed in a local community in Florida could govern, you know, what a site does all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Sure, that's right. And I think just as a preliminary point, you know, it's important to distinguish self-censorship from censorship, even though they're members of the same family. There's a difference between YouTube deciding for itself to remove content and a legal authority making that decision for YouTube or blocking access altogether to YouTube. But, you know, that being said, I think the whole controversy surrounding the Innocence of Muslims video just demonstrates how, you know, internet companies, which most of them are based in the United States, have become arbiters of free speech on a global scale. And as one commentator pointed out, the companies are weighing issues and interests that traditionally have been the province of courts and international treaties. You know, companies, as you mentioned, Mark, that operate on a global scale, they have to obey local laws. So they have to obey the laws of every country where the companies operate. That's not only a compliance problem. You know, how do you restrict one type of content in this country but not in that country? It's also a philosophical problem insofar as the company has to decide whether a country's laws and democratic processes are so incompatible with the company's principles that the company just can't comply or operate there. Google's policy statements on free expression say that the company struggles with those very problems. In the case of the Innocence of Muslims video, Google blocked the video in India and Indonesia because it violated local laws. That was, I think, very different from the decision the company made to block the video in Libya and Egypt, where it blocked it because of what it described as the very difficult situation in those countries. And then, you know, meanwhile, in the U.S., Google declined to remove the video because it did not attack a group, Muslims, and therefore constitute hate speech. It attacked a religion, Islam. And, you know, the statement that they put out, you know, just noted that the video is widely available on the web and clearly within the guidelines. And as a commentator for The Atlantic pointed out, you know, this is a really interesting and perhaps unprecedented move, because by its own assessment, the video is within the company's guidelines. And at the same time, the company has decided to make it unavailable. So then you wonder, well, what then are the criteria that Google is using to make these decisions, which I think, you know, swings back to what Susan mentioned, that we need to be a little bit more transparent about those criteria. And, you know, again, this another point, I guess, just piggybacking on what Trevor said. One of the problems here is a lack of global legal norms. I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago in a very different context, but, you know, we've got a reality where local restrictions are no longer local, but, you know, our global marketplace is a series of jurisdictional silos, from speech restrictive regimes to speech protective regimes. And that's a really, really big practical challenge for any global internet company.
Yeah, can I just jump in here? I think that's a great point, and we've kind of seen that over the last couple weeks with other situations. In Brazil, they threatened to arrest a Google executive when they refused to take down a video that was making fun of a politician. And actually in Greece, just 2 days ago, the birthplace of democracy, they arrested somebody for blasphemy, for making fun of a Greek Orthodox monk. And so when these large companies have offices in these countries, they put their own employees at risk by not following these court orders, that we would consider absurd in the U.S. And so they have to follow them whether we like it or not. And it's hard to criticize them otherwise, because, you know, they are putting their own skin at risk because they can end up in jail. You know, it's different for these companies in other countries where they don't have offices. So when Saudi Arabia or Iran asks or demands that YouTube take something down, they have generally, you know, they don't respond because they have no consequences if they don't. So as these companies become bigger and bigger and more global, they will continue to run into these problems. The next big problem they'll probably face is in India, where they have been trying to institute a variety of censorship measures, even though it's the world's largest democracy. And all of these companies obviously want to do business in India, but they're eventually going to have to at least work with the government to you know, relax some of these laws, or they could end up facing jail time.
But I guess, I mean, if you guys are saying that, I mean, I guess the solution is pretty obvious, which is if you have an office, if you do business, you have employees in certain countries, then you essentially just obey the law there or whatever the judicial restrictions are there, unless you want to take a moral or a legal stand against the law that, let's say in India, you are against the law, then you are against the law, the censorship law that the government is putting up there, then you make a stand and take a stand. Otherwise, I guess you just have to comply with the rules there, right? Is that, but then for trying to do that in 200 countries is a impossible task, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I mean, think
about what Google did in China too, where they decided rather than censor, they, you know, that they would just kind of pull out.
Well, right. But then they went back in. The other point that I think is important to bear in mind is the practical side of things. Even if Google blocks a video or another piece of content in a particular country, it's very likely, just as was the case in Libya and Egypt, that people in that country can still see the content. After all, YouTube is not the only place on the web where one can post a video.
Yeah.
So we can look on the one hand at law and rules, and on the other hand, what the practical reality is. And it's worth noting in the case of the innocence of Muslims that in contrast to other very provocative content or what we might call acts of speech that have met with violence on the part of certain people and communities, the innocence of Muslims can't be described as a work of art, and arguably doesn't have any purpose other than to provoke Muslims. In addition, if we assume that that's true, that it was made in order to provoke Muslims and not for any other purpose, then unfortunately it was very, very successful. So there's no doubt that Google and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter are going to face more such cases.
I think you made a great point about the practicality of censorship, especially on the internet these days, because, you know, we've seen so many times when governments or companies try to censor something online lately, you know, it kind of backfires on them. Not only does it work, not only does it not work, it backfires. You know, it's called the Streisand effect, where when somebody wants something censored, all of a sudden everybody wants to see it, and they start spreading it around, and it can be mirrored on all these different websites. And you're right, it's impossible to censor these types of videos, even if we wanted to a lot of times. And so the best solution may be, in a lot of these cases, is just to ignore it, because just by drawing attention to it, you're going to end up giving it more publicity and more people will see it. But, you know, it's hard to judge one piece of material based on its artistic quality. You know, when something was actually not in the video ever actually calling for violence, if we're going to go case by case and judge whether something's artistic or not, or has, you know, a certain social value, that's going to get us in a really sticky situation down the road. When first of all, there's just too much to, you know, look at. And second, you know, where do we draw the line? I mean, is South Park, are they inflammatory? They've had, you know, the pictures and or depictions of Muhammad on their show. Is it, you know, is it provocative to do this to another religion? We could use the South Park guys again as an example in their Book of Mormon show that's been so successful online. Are we just judging by because Muslims have reacted differently than other religions when they are made fun of in an objectionable and grotesque manner? It's a really sticky situation we can get in when we start judging things based on these case-by-case bases.
I'd like to make another suggestion. Since censorship doesn't really work, in other words, even if Google or YouTube blocks content, it's very likely that people will be able to see it. And also the content is likely only to come to the attention of Google and the rest of us once there's already been a violent reaction, if that's what's going to take place. So censorship is not a good solution, but Google and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter have enormous influence all over the world, especially in countries that are trying to work out their own rules on freedom of expression. So it would be useful for those companies to explain the decisions that they make when, as in this case, they make their own internal decisions to block content even temporarily. An explanation like that can do a lot to disseminate an idea about freedom of expression. For example, Google could have posted a little notice at the URL where the Innocence of Muslims Arabic version was blocked in Egypt and Libya, which could have said, this video has been temporarily blocked in your country because of the violent response to it, although no content ever justifies a violent response, or no video can be used to justify violence.
And what about your idea, Susan? You wrote this piece for Foreign Policy with Rebecca McKinnon, and you kind of built on Tim Wu from Columbia had this idea of YouTube or Google setting, or YouTube specifically setting up kind of like a community of kind of regular users who might help make kind of decisions on some of the content. And I guess you extended that and said, you know, why not have that kind of as an online forum that exists on like a third party site?
Well, what we said is that Tim Wu's suggestion that experts help to make decisions about when to block content wouldn't work because those decisions have to be made extremely quickly. In fact, even as I said, even once Google decided to block the content in Libya and Egypt, arguably it was too late because violence had already taken place. So what Rebecca and I suggested instead is that a third-party organization or communities of users could contribute to a very useful cross-cultural international conversation about decisions to block or not block controversial content.
Of course, here we're all assuming that all the content that's infringing is in English language. I mean, imagine the language-specific thing that most of the rest of the world will not even understand and could potentially be sort of micro-targeted. And that's even like 10 times more difficult than what we're talking about here.
So I think Susan makes a great point about transparency in these companies, and that's definitely part of the solution here. You know, when YouTube blocked the video in the two countries, Libya and Egypt, even though they did it without a court order, actually on their website for the first 24 hours, it said they had taken it down because of legal action. And so it was very confusing for viewers to figure out why it was actually blocked. You know, Google in general has been fairly good, at least, at you know, expressing its policies on what they would censor and what they wouldn't. Facebook, on the other hand, has not. They've been very opaque and vague about their censorship policies, and they're actually much more restrictive than Google or Twitter's. You know, they take down a lot of speech. You know, anything indecent or, you know, way beyond just this Innocence of Muslim video. Again, these companies have much more power than actual governments to censor anybody they like these days, and that's kind of the problem on the horizon is that now the power is shifting, and we have to figure out how to hold companies accountable for this instead of just governments.
Jonathan, did you want to talk about some of the other cases of kind of blocked and pulled down content and how these companies dealt with them?
Oh, sure. Yeah. YouTube wrestled with a similarly difficult question during the 2009 street protest in Iran. This was when a young woman, a 26-year-old protester, was shot and killed. Her final moments were captured in a video that was then posted to YouTube. And one YouTube insider said that the video probably violated the company's community guidelines regarding graphic content, but the company decided to keep it up on the platform because it was so newsworthy and depicted news events. And you know, Mark, you mentioned Google's problems in China. Until 2010, Google had agreed to censor its search results in mainland China. And when the company ended that agreement, Google began routing all of its Chinese traffic through Hong Kong servers beyond the reach of Beijing's censorial laws. So mainland users can still use Google, but the connection tends to break if they search for certain terms. In other words, it's no longer Google doing the censoring, it's the government and the so-called Great Firewall of China. And then I'm not sure if you saw this last summer, but Google just fired off a new salvo in its ongoing battle with Beijing, and it basically added a feature to Google China that warns users who enter sensitive search terms that entering those terms might break their connection to Google. And then the feature also suggests alternate terms. You know, another example, I mean, this is an example of a choke point of speech, I guess, would be payment service providers. You know, they can serve as a choke point that has the effect of blocking content. They make it possible for users to send and receive payments online, which can provide, you know, the support that, you know, politicians need, that activists need, that writers need, and so on. You know, examples I'm thinking of might be SpotUs or Kickstarter or Indiegogo. And you know, the threat here is that governments and private actors can pressure the payment providers to cut off a speaker's means of support. And I think prime example would be WikiLeaks. In 2010, the organization really, really struggled to cover its operating expenses because PayPal and other services, I think Amazon was one of them, bowed to government pressure and refused to process the organization's donations. So just a different way to kind of slip in the back door there and create an effect of blocking content.
Yeah, those are really good examples. Well, thanks, guys. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Delighted. Enjoy.
This was great. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our sponsor, the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, as well as my co-host, Rafat Ali, and our guests, Susan Benesh, Jonathan Peters, and Trevor Tim. And PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idealab, at pbs.org/idealab and our sister site, Collaboration Central, at collaborationcentral.org. We'll catch you next week.